Okay, good morning, everybody. We're about ready to start. This is Bio 241, and it is September 29th, and we're going to finish up just a couple slides on enzymes and energy. That's chapter 4, and then move into cell respiration, which is chapter 5. Okay, and so let's get started. I'm going to turn some lights down, and I first want to review just a little bit of what we did last time. But does anybody have a question? Anybody have a question before I get started? No? Okay, I forgot I want to go over the schedule. All right, so today is the 29th. Indeed, we're going to start cell respiration. Got a couple of lectures on that. And then three whole lectures on nervous system. So that's a big, major part of the class. So if you want to get a head start on that, that would be great. Autonomic nervous system, you're kind of familiar with that already, but that will be on the test that's coming up on October 20th. So if today's the 29th, that is 3 weeks away. Okay, 3 weeks away is your next test. And here is a nice warm-up question for you. How do you prepare for the lecture exams in here? What's your number one resource besides me? The study guide. Yes, please print those study guides out right away. Start working on them. Actually, you don't have to print them out, but you could download them, keep them on your hard drive or whatever computer you're using. That's fine, but I'm pretty much old school, so I would like to print them out. So on test number 2, it's going to be chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9, which will be that next test. So, yes, those study guides are real important. When I go to make up a test, I go to the study guide to know what I should test you guys on. Right? So it makes perfect sense that if you're going to study for a test, you go to the study guide as well to see what I'm going to test you on. Right? Because the test comes right out of the study guide. Not that it's easy, not that it really shortens things up, but at least it organizes things for you. All right, any question on the schedule? We're good with that? Okay. All right, so last time we were talking about enzymes and energy. And remember, with modern nomenclature, if there is an enzyme, we're going to put an ASE at the end of that word. And sometimes we'll use the name of a substrate and then put ASE at the end of the word. So, for instance, a lipase is an enzyme because there's an ASE on the end of the word. And what is the substrate for a lipase? Because, yeah, it's a lipid, right? It's part of the name. So, a lipid. There are a couple other enzymes you had to know, and I think it's good that we're going to just review it really quick. And that is an enzyme that can either add a phosphate group to another large molecule or take a phosphate group off. And these two enzymes are going to be called a kinase, and the other one is a phosphatase. And so which one takes a phosphate group off? The phosphatase. What enzyme will add a phosphate group to something else? A kinase. That's right. So you might think, well, gee whiz, why do we have enzymes that do the opposite things? And that's because they're working antagonistic to each other, and that's a very important property of any kind of control system, right? Antagonism. Like the nervous system. What nervous system are you aware of that works in opposition to each other? The sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Exactly. And because they are antagonistic to each other, and a good example is on the heart. One speeds the heart up, the other slows the heart down. Your nervous system has precise control and balance of your heart because of those antagonistic systems. And as a matter of fact, hopefully I mentioned this last time, even in your car, you have antagonistic control mechanisms, and you would never dream of driving your car without these two antagonistic mechanisms. And those are the brake pedal and gas pedal. That's right. And if you only had one, say if you only had a gas pedal, sure, maybe you could make it home after work, but once you got home, what would happen? You just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop, right? So that's what you need the brake pedal for. So that will give you precise control and balance over your car. And so here is a biochemical mechanism of antagonism providing precise control of either activating or inactivating enzymes by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating them. We're going to take a look at that. All right, so let me review just this slide right here. This is just a plot of free energy of some molecules, and here we have glucose and oxygen plotted along time, right? And we see that this glucose is going to be broken down into smaller and smaller pieces and finally end up with CO2, carbon dioxide. And I see six carbon dioxides. So how many carbons were in glucose when this process started? Yeah, six. Glucose is a six carbon sugar. Right, and we see under this metabolic pathway, these are some intermediates. They're not exactly labeled, but each step is an intermediate in this pathway. Right, and in this particular case, the products have less energy than the reactants. Right, so what kind of reaction is that? Endergonic or exergonic? If the products have less, it is exergonic. That means it's going to be releasing energy. Right, releasing energy when this biochemical pathway takes place, and that energy can be used by the rest of the mechanisms inside your cells to do a couple of things. Right, and that's where this next statement comes from. Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP. This is pretty confusing, but okay, what did you say right here? Glucose going through carbon dioxide is what, exergonic or endergonic? It's exergonic, right? So it's going to be releasing energy, and then this energy can be used to make ATP. Right? So that's why that statement is written just the way it is. Here is a large exergonic biochemical pathway. It's releasing energy, and that energy can be used to put into chemical bonds inside ATP. And that's what this double wheel, these two gears right here, represent. Right? So here, this large wheel represents that biochemical pathway that we were looking at with all those different steps, and when it releases energy, right, because here are products, it has lower energy compared to the reactants, so this is an exergonic reaction when this wheel turns. It is coupled to another biochemical mechanism right here, which is going to take reactants from low energy to high energy as an endergonic reaction, and this is, for instance, the best way to look at this one right here, write it in your notes, is the production of ATP. So the reactants would be ADP and inorganic phosphate producing ATP. And when you look at this diagram, can you tell that ATP has more energy compared to ADP and inorganic phosphate? Because that is the way that this vertical axis is labeled. As you go up this vertical axis, then those molecules have more energy. All right, so I thought that was terribly confusing the way the book has it laid out. But does that make sense now, that most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP? Because it's confusing, because when you make ATP, what kind of reaction is it? It's an endorganic reaction, right? When you make ATP, that's endorganic, and that can only be driven by other reactions that are exergonic. So remember, energy can't be created or destroyed. They can only be converted from one form to another, right? And so this pathway right here, energy is being converted from glucose, right, into ATP. Right? It's not 100% efficient, but nonetheless, that works really nice. All right, so let me write something on the board. And let me know if I should turn our light on. We have, let's use this diagram. Okay. So don't look at the title of this diagram, because we have ADP. Guess what? I'm going to turn some lights on. ADP, and we're going to make. Okay, we're going to make ATP out of it, right? But we haven't really balanced this equation. There are other things that we have to put into this equation to make it work. So on the left-hand side, what do we have to put down? If we start with ADP to make ATP, what does this T stand for? Tri, and what does the D stand for? Diphosphate. So what do we have to put in on the left-hand side? Inorganic phosphate. At least I think I heard you say that. I hope you said that. I don't want to be just telling you the answer, right? Inorganic phosphate. So remember, that's a PO4 group. It's just not a phosphorus atom, but it's an inorganic phosphate. That's what that little I means. Okay, so we got two phosphates here, one phosphate here, you end up with three, but we're missing something really important, okay? And it's a real thing, but you can't really hold it up in your hand. right? We can measure it with a thermometer, and that would be energy. So where do we put energy? On the left-hand side or the right-hand side? It's the left-hand side. That's really nice if you see that. So here I'm going to put energy. All right, so that's a real thing, just as real as inorganic phosphate, just as real as ADP. So if this is the reaction, right, we're putting energy into it, what kind of reaction is this? Is it exergonic or endergonic? Okay, so here, these things have less energy than ATP, so this is an endergonic reaction. All right, and then if you have ATP, your body can use ATP when it breaks it down to ADP plus inorganic phosphate, and then what else is missing? Energy, right? And this energy right here, energy can be used for muscle contraction, nerve impulses, okay? All kinds of processes in this reaction right here. So what kind of reaction is this? ATP being broken down to ADP. Exergonic, right? Alright, so that's really good if you see that, especially before we get into the next chapter, which is cell respiration. Alright, I got a couple slides left to show you in this particular chapter. So let me make this really big. I'll turn some lights off in just a second. Alright, so ATP. ATP is produced when we have adenosine diphosphate combining with inorganic phosphate, producing ATP. Here is the chemical formula for ATP. It's sort of a large molecule. It's a nucleotide, right? And is it a ribo or deoxyribo? It's a ribo, right, because here is that OH group. And off of this first carbon, I see three phosphates, hence triphosphate. This is the triphosphate. And this little squiggly line right here represents a chemical bond. And there's energy in chemical bonds, and since it's a squiggly line, it should alert you to the fact that this is typically a stronger kind of covalent bond than we would find in other parts of this molecule or other molecules. And when that bond is broken, that energy is released, right? And so when this bond is broken or this one over here is broken, then that becomes an exergonic reaction, and that energy can be used to run numerous cellular processes in your body. All right, so somebody should tell me why this slide is horrible. It's missing something. What is it missing? It's missing energy. Where would you put energy on this particular slide? On top, right? So yeah, put energy. So put energy plus ADP plus inorganic phosphate goes to ATP. Okay? Oh, and you want to put some water in there? That would be great too. Okay, that would be fine because that would be a hydrolysis reaction, right? When you break down ATP, or it would be a dehydration synthesis reaction, right, when you make ATP. So that would be really nice for you to put down too. All right, so don't forget about that endergonic, exergonic reaction. Here is another whole class of reactions that we're going to become familiar with. They're called oxidation reduction reactions. And oxidation reduction reactions always happen together. You can never have an oxidation reaction happening by itself, right? You can never have a reduction reaction ever happening by itself. They have to be paired together. So that means there's got to be at least two molecules. When one is oxidized, the other becomes reduced. That's just the nature of this kind of reaction, right? And probably you should just really memorize this definition and maybe write it out, even on a test, write it out, because sometimes it can be confusing. It seems really simple, but these are kind of like mind-bending kind of questions sometimes. All right, so if a molecule gains an electron, we call it reduced. So gain electron, then that is reduction. All right, and what did we say about oxidation-reduction reactions? If one molecule is reduced, what happens to its companion? It becomes oxidized, right? And hence we get to this second line right here. If a molecule loses electrons, it becomes oxidized. All right, so oxidation reduction reactions have to do about transferring electrons from one molecule to another. They do change energy states. Usually that that electron has a high energy associated with it. All right, so what happens to a molecule when it gains an electron? It becomes reduced. What happens to a molecule when it loses an electron? It becomes oxidized, right? Okay, so a reducing agent donates electrons, right? So a reducing agent can reduce something. And what happens to the reducing agent after it donates electrons to someplace? It becomes oxidized, right? So a reducing agent becomes oxidized when it does its work. And the same thing for an oxidizing agent. An oxidizing agent accepts electrons. So when this reaction takes place, what happens to an oxidizing agent? It becomes reduced, but its companion becomes oxidized. All right, so I would just start with this definition of these first two lines over here and always, always, always rely on that definition, and you'll be able to work through any kind of question, even the third and fourth lines on this particular slide. So reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. Sometimes they involve transfers of hydrogen ions or protons instead of electrons, but in this class, I'm going to focus on just the transfer of electrons. Your book does talk about protons, but I'm going to ignore that and just talk about electrons because that's what our basic definition is right here. There are some coenzymes that play important roles as, and you can cross off protons right here, as electron carriers. And here are a couple really important coenzymes, NAD, and your book kind of misspells this thing all the time. It should be NAD plus. Right, so NAD is an ion, has a positive charge to it, and FAD doesn't have a plus or a minus. Both of these things in this state can accept electrons. All right, so if NAD can accept an electron, I'm sorry, if NAD plus can accept an electron, what state is NAD plus in? Is it oxidized state or reduced? It is the oxidized state, right? NAD plus is oxidized. When it accepts electrons, it becomes reduced. All right, what state is FAD in right now? It is oxidized. It will be able to accept the electrons, and when it does, it becomes reduced. All right, so what does, you know what? Maybe I'll draw that on the board too, really fast. I'll kind of abbreviate it. Because there are some, actually two electrons that move, but we're just going to go like this. All right, so NAD has a plus sign on it. Hopefully I'll remember to mention that every time. And FAD, okay, this whole column right here, this is the oxidized form. And to get to the reduced form, what has to happen? On this side, you have to add some electrons, right? So we're going to put, let's just put two electrons right here. Same thing for FADH, two electrons. Right? And then they become reduced. This is the form that we're going to be looking at, NAD, NADH. Okay, but don't forget there's two electrons in there. They're high energy electrons. And FAD is going to be converted into FADH. That's good for now. And there's some high energy electrons, right? So these are what we call high energy intermediates, almost like ATP. These things can be used to make ATP. And do you see that this is an oxidation reduction reaction? Okay. These electrons don't come from nowhere. They come from someplace, right? But this is just looking at NAD and FAD. Yeah. Two. NADFH2. Okay, FAD, no positive. NAD has got a positive sign. Okay, so these are coenzymes. And a lot of coenzymes start in your body as vitamins. Vitamins are compounds that your body can't make. They're large organic compounds, and you need to have a dietary source for them because our biochemistry can't make these things anymore. All right, so this is kind of a loaded slide for a number of reasons because of this oxidation reduction terminology, but also coenzyme. We have to remind ourselves what a coenzyme is. We learned something with that has this co in front of it. We learned of two co-somethings. Coenzymes is one, and what is the other co-something? The cofactor, right? A cofactor and coenzyme, and we should really have straight in our mind, what's the difference between a cofactor and a coenzyme? And I tell you what, let's start with a cofactor first, even though we got coenzyme here. What's a cofactor? Small, tiny molecule. It's an atom, right? It's an ion. Could be like magnesium, right? Or calcium. So a cofactor is something small, but a coenzyme is large, right? And I think, remember, an enzyme is a large protein. Coenzyme then is going to be large like an enzyme, and it's going to have some special kinds of functional groups on it. It's just not a protein, because your body can make proteins. These things are large organic compounds, and we can see them on this slide. All right, so this top slide right here, we have, oh, and this, in your book it's correct, we have NADH. Look at this big, huge molecule here. All right, it's got a couple riboses, some phosphates, kind of reminds me of ATP to a large extent. And so I see two nucleotides put together, and that's what this D stands for, nicotinamide dinucleotide. That's what that di stands for. So there are two nucleotides put together, and two electrons can be put in this position right here. And then instead of having NAD, what are we going to have over here? NADH. And in NADH, what form is that? Oxidized or reduced? NADH. It's going to be the reduced form, and those electrons have high energy. The other molecule that I see over here, FAD, kind of similar. It has a nucleotide with some other different kind of group over here. It can accept two electrons as well, and FAD is going to be converted into FADH2. FADH2 is the reduced form. It has high energy electrons that can be used by your body, for instance, to make ATP. You don't have to become familiar with these compounds, right? I'm not going to test you on the shape of these things. I think the big reason why I'm showing you this is because it is obvious these things are not what? These two things are obvious, they're not cofactors, right? They're not cofactors because they're huge organic molecules. These things are coenzymes. And remember, a coenzyme is a big organic molecule that carries something from one set of chemical reactions to another set of chemical reactions. And so NADH is going to carry something from one type of biochemical pathway to another. And what is that something that NADH is carrying? Because remember, NADH is reduced, it's carrying electrons, but more importantly, what you should know, what about those electrons? You should know that they are high energy electrons, right? So NADH is carrying high energy electrons from one biochemical pathway to another, and since it's carrying something from one pathway to another pathway, and it's a big, huge organic molecule, it is a coenzyme. Same thing, exact same thing for FADH2. The slide is kind of nice, and I think it just happened by luck, but NADH, this molecule, has more free energy than FADH2. So just maybe draw a little vertical scale right here with free energy, and you can see that NADH is higher up on that scale compared to FADH2. And that's going to become important later on in the next chapter. All right, so who's got a question about this? Oxidation reduction or cofactors, coenzymes, any of that kind of stuff? Yes.
I just wanted to confirm my understanding. Like, so when you're at an oxidative state and you accept the electrons, they're going to turn reduced.
Okay. The question is, when you're in an oxidized form and you accept the electrons, yes, you become reduced or you become, yeah, you become in, you are in the reduced state after you accept those electrons, okay? This is true. So just rely on that basic information, start there, and you'll be able to come to the correct answer. There's a lot of questions, end of chapter and online questions to practice. oxidation reduction reactions. Okay, all right, I'm going to go to the next chapter. Next chapter, cell respiration and metabolism. We're going to be looking at biochemical pathways, all right, and between the molecule that enters a biochemical pathway and the last one that leaves, all of those molecules in between are going to be called intermediates in that particular pathway. Here are some that we're going to look at: glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and we'll look at fat metabolism. Probably won't talk very much about protein metabolism formally in the class. All right, well, let's break metabolism down. All right, so we're going to be looking at metabolism. Metabolism just refers to all of the chemical reactions taking place in your body at any particular time. Right, so molecules are going to interconvert, right, they're going to change form. That is metabolism. For instance, like glucose being chopped in half or being chopped down completely to carbon dioxide, that is metabolism. Right? And then making ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate, that is metabolism as well, but those are two different kinds. The two different kinds of metabolism that we're going to be looking at, okay, are catabolism and anabolism. Catabolism breaks down large molecules. All right, so this is going to be a hydrolysis reaction. And what can you tell me? Oh, I erased it. Rats. What kind of reaction is ATP being broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate? That's a hydrolysis reaction. Okay, and what else is being released? Energy, right? So catabolism breaks down large molecules into smaller ones and releases energy. Right, so those are exorganic reactions. So catabolism is exorganic. That's the primary source of energy for making ATP. When you break down, for instance, really large molecules like glucose, turning them into small ones like carbon dioxide, that releases energy, and that energy can be used to make ATP. Anabolism, on the other hand, makes larger molecules from a bunch of smaller ones, and that requires energy. Like a dehydration synthesis reaction requires energy. And anabolism is the source of body's large energy storage compounds. So a lot of energy can be stored in large molecules when your body builds them up. And a really good example of a large molecule that stores a lot of energy is going to be glycogen. You've probably heard of something that's really similar to glycogen. You've heard of starch. Anybody have ever heard of starch before? Yeah. And does anybody know what the building block of starch is? It's sugar. It's glucose in particular. So starch is just a big, huge sugar molecule all jammed together, many hundreds or thousands of glucoses put together, right? And that is a storage form of energy. And when your body needs energy, it can break glycogen down, right? And what happens when you break a molecule down? It releases energy, right? So when glycogen or starch is broken down, it releases energy, and your body can then use that energy for other purposes, like maybe, for instance, for making ATP. Okay, your body can store other large molecules that store energy, and a good example of that would be like a triglyceride is a large molecule. Fats contain a lot of energy, and when they're broken down by catabolism, that releases energy, for instance, maybe for making ATP. All right, so that's catabolism and anabolism. One is exergonic, one is endergonic. Here is a really important exam figure. And as a matter of fact, I would really like for you to be able to understand what's happening on this figure. And I'll say right off the bat that the most important point on this figure is missing. It's not drawn on the figure. So I want you to figure out what's missing from this illustration, and you'll really understand the importance of this thing. All right, so let's describe what's happening here. I see three different compartments right here, and they're in rows. Here's the top row, here's the second row, sort of in the middle, here's the third, sort of in the middle, and then the last one. Can you see three different colors right in here? That's good. I don't know, this color and this color kind of looks the same, but anyway, hopefully it's different for you. All right, so this top row right here signifies where glucose is coming from in your body. And it represents two different states, two different possible states that you could be in. So here is the digestive system, or your alimentary canal, and when you eat something, there's a lot of glucose inside your digestive system that you can absorb. It can be absorbed into your body. Right. And then, so what are we going to call this state right here? When you have food being digested and glucose being absorbed, this is what we call the fed state, F-E-D, right? When you eat something, there's food in here, we call that the fed state. The other kind of state that your body could be in, instead of being fed, is, I don't know, take a guess, what other state could you be in? Fed and fasted, fantastic, right? So over here where we see a picture of a liver, this is representing the fasted state. When you're in the fasted state, you don't have glucose in your digestive tract being absorbed, okay? But fortunately, the liver stores a lot of glucose in the form of glycogen, right? So glycogen is very much like starch. Glycogen is an animal starch. Starch is what we find in plants, and the building block is the same. It's glucose, but it's put together a little bit differently. Glycogen is a little bit more, has more branches to it, more complicated branching pattern compared to starch. All right, so when you eat pasta or a potato, it's like eating glucose, right? Because it's just starch. All right, so glucose can enter the blood. So that's what this second row represents. It's the blood. And what do I see here? I see a nice simple squamous endothelium right here. So what kind of blood vessel is this? Kind of a little side light, but you should know what's happening here. We see glucose entering the blood. What kind of blood vessel allows movement across the blood vessel from inside the blood to outside, or from the interstitial space into the blood? What kind of blood vessel is that? It's got to be a capillary, right? So here's a nice simple squamous epithelium designed for diffusion. All right, so glucose can enter the blood a couple different ways depending on whether you're in a fed state or fasted state. So what happens to glucose in the blood? It goes up, right? Whether you're in the fed or fasted state, blood glucose goes up, okay? And then that glucose can enter a cell, right? So it's going to diffuse out of the blood and enter a cell. Glucose can't do that unless it gets a really important signal from your pancreas, right? Or usually can't happen without this signal. And it's a hormone. Does anybody, you all know the name of this hormone. Okay, what's the signal that tells this cell right here to take up glucose? Without that signal, this cell is going to starve to death because it won't take up glucose. And that hormone is called insulin, right? Insulin. So if cells don't have insulin, they can't take up glucose, so where does glucose stay? High in the blood without insulin. So this is an interesting figure for that respect too. All right, so you don't have to put insulin in here, but you're going to become familiar with that. Okay, so we've had glucose from your digestive tract going into the blood, going inside the cell, right? Glucose in the cell, and it says in the cell cytoplasm, not in an organelle just floating around in the cytosol. Glucose can be broken down by a process that we call glycolysis. And tell me, how many carbon atoms does glucose have? It's got six. This process here is going to break glucose down into two exactly the same compounds, molecules, right? And that's called pyruvic acid. And since glucose is broken down exactly into two of these, how many carbons are in each pyruvic acid? There's got to be three, right? So, and what does this term lysis refer to? What does lysis mean? Breaking down, right? When a cell lyses, it breaks down or blows up. A lysosome is a vesicle inside of a cell that breaks things down, right? So anytime you hear this term lysis, you should think of something being broken down into simpler forms. And glycolysis just means the breaking down of glucose from a large molecule to two smaller ones. And what that happens is that an anabolic or catabolic reaction, when a big goes to some smaller ones. That's a catabolic reaction. And in general, what can you tell me about the energy of a catabolic reaction? Exergonic or endergonic? Exergonic, right. So glycolysis is an exergonic biochemical pathway. There are a number of intermediates, right? And where does that happen? Where does glycolysis take place? In the cytoplasm, not inside an organelle. And if you want to say cytosol, that might even be better, right? Because cytoplasm refers to organelles as well, but not in this particular case. All right, so since it is an exorganic reaction, there's something missing right here. There's energy being released, right? Okay, so we got two pyruvic acids. Pyruvic acid, oh, you know what? Pyruvic acid, you can call it pyruvate. Pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same compound, exactly identical. And maybe I'll use both of these words in the same sentence, pyruvic acid and pyruvate. Okay, just sort of be aware of that. Pyruvic acid has two possible fates, depending on what's happening inside your body. If oxygen is high, we call that an aerobic condition. When oxygen is high, then pyruvic acid will enter one biochemical pathway. But if oxygen is low, pyruvic acid will enter a different biochemical pathway. Right? So without oxygen, that's called anaerobic respiration. With oxygen, we call that aerobic respiration. Right? And I'm going to come back to anaerobic respiration in just a little bit, because here's an important step. Pyruvic acid can enter mitochondria. That's an organelle. Under what condition can pyruvic acid enter a mitochondria? When oxygen is high or low? When oxygen is high, right? So pyruvic acid can only get inside the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. Oxygen has to be high. Well, when we're exercising really strenuously, when a muscle contracts, blood can't get into that muscle. And so oxygen can't get into that muscle, so sometimes our muscles work anaerobically, right? So if our muscles are anaerobic, what happens to pyruvic acid? Does it go straight down, or does it take this pathway to the right? It gets diverted to this pathway on the right. We call that anaerobic respiration, and when pyruvic acid gets diverted over here, it produces lactic acid. Lactic acid has three carbons, just like pyruvic acid. But we're going to see that this anaerobic pathway replenishes some intermediates that glycolysis needs in order to operate. Okay, and a couple other things. Right, but too much to talk about in this slide. All right, if oxygen is present, right, pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria, and probably you should fill this in right here. See this tiny little arrow? That's an important pathway, actually just one step. It doesn't have a lot of intermediates, but we're going to call this the preparatory reaction. Preparatory reaction, a big word for such a little arrow. Preparatory reaction. And that's going to take, right, what's left over from pyruvate into, it's preparatory to what reaction? It's preparatory to a Krebs cycle. That's a metabolic pathway. And you're going to see that it really operates as a cycle. Okay, and when the Krebs cycle is operating, it produces some high energy electrons. It produces high energy electrons. That's what maybe you could draw right above this little arrow that's coming off. Okay, and those high energy electrons go to the electron transport chain. And when it does, right, you're going to make water and carbon dioxide. That's the overall reaction with this lower line right here. Okay. Probably some things that maybe I want you to draw in right now, just for consistency. How many carbons does pyruvic acid have? Okay, it has three. This preparatory reaction will produce one CO2. So maybe we'll draw a little arrow with a CO2 right there coming off. Okay, so that's a catabolic reaction. And the Krebs cycle then will produce how many CO2s? If there's three in pyruvic acid and one comes off with the preparatory reaction, how many then are released by the Krebs cycle? There are two, right? So for every pyruvic acid, there are three CO2s being produced, right? One by the preparatory reaction, two by Krebs cycle. So a really good standard question to ask somebody is, what part of the cell produces CO2 for us? Is it cytosol? Or is it an organelle? And if it's an organelle, which organelle is it? And it's really handy because this slide tells you that. Okay? So what organelle produces CO2? Mitochondria, right? Produces CO2. Okay? All three. So you could put maybe three CO2s over here. And mitochondria need oxygen in order for this to work, right? Because this is aerobic respiration. That oxygen turns into the oxygen in this water molecule. That's where that oxygen goes. All right, so here's a really good description. Whenever we talk about anything in this chapter coming up, I want you to refer to this illustration right here. Right, because we're going to talk about some of these pieces, individual pieces, but it would be really important for you to know the whole picture. Right, we're going to dissect this all these biochemical pathways down, but I want you to have a really good integrated view of what's happening inside your body. Okay, so I talked a lot. I talked about production of CO2, talked about production of lactic acid, right? Production of water, breaking of glucose down to pyruvic acid, all right? But remember I said that the important thing is not drawn on the slide, and I haven't mentioned it yet. And I want you over the next couple of days to figure out what it is that's missing from this diagram, but if you know what it is right now, don't tell anybody, okay? And I know you might be really dying to tell somebody. Okay, so what's the purpose of all of these pathways right here? Is the purpose to break down glucose into pyruvic acid? Is that the most important thing? And the answer will be no. Okay, is the most important thing the conversion of pyruvic acid into lactic acid under anaerobic conditions? Is that the most important thing? Answer is going to be no. Right, well, what is the most important thing? Pyruvic acid being broken down inside the mitochondria by the prep reaction or Krebs cycle, is that the most important thing? And again, the answer is no. Okay, and how about the most important thing? Well, I said it already, producing CO2 in water. Is that important? No, that's not the most important thing. So draw on your slide as soon as you know it, what is the most important thing that all of these biochemical pathways are allowing your body to do? So we're starting with a large molecule, breaking it down into smaller ones. Right, so if we go glucose to carbon dioxide all the way down over here, is that an exergonic or endergonic set of biochemical pathways? Large to small is catabolism. It is exergonic. And what did we say that exergonic reactions can make? Don't say it out loud. Exergonic reactions can make what in your body? Okay, so draw that molecule in, and maybe next time I'll tell you what it is. But I'm sure you're going to discover what it is all by itself anyway. Okay? Okay. Raise your hand if you know right now. Almost everybody knows already. Okay? Well, don't feel bad if you don't know. Okay? Because there's no reason why you would know until you take this class. All right. So, important slide. I'll send you an email soon that will tell you how to draw that slide out for extra credit in lab, because it's so important that you have a nice picture in your mind of everything. All right, so what is this first step that happens when glucose enters a cell? It gets snipped in half, right? Under glycolysis. Glycolysis is the metabolic pathway, so let's talk about that first. Okay, it's a metabolic pathway where glucose, told you this already, is converted into two pyruvates. What's another name for pyruvate? Pyruvic acid, okay? And this step does not require oxygen. It can happen if there's oxygen inside the cell, or if oxygen is really low inside the cell. It can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. It really doesn't matter. Here is the overall net equation. You have glucose, right? We started with glucose, and then we need two of these NAD pluses. Maybe put a little plus right here. And you need a couple of ADPs, a couple of inorganic phosphates, and when glucose gets split into half, you get two pyruvates, you get two NADHs, right? Now tell me something special about NADH. What's happening there? Is it oxidized or reduced? It's the reduced form, right? Because it has accepted some electrons. By definition, that's what reduction means, but tell me something about those electrons that it has accepted to become reduced. They are high energy electrons, right? So there's energy stored in NADH, right? And then we have a couple ATPs that are produced as well. So here is the overall net reaction. So glycolysis is exergonic, and it produces two NADHs, two ATPs. Right, but remember, when you have any kind of chemical reaction, before the reaction takes place, you have to put in some activation energy. Even though there are enzymes in glycolysis, it still requires some activation energy to get started, and it requires two ATPs to get started. So glycolysis does initially require two ATPs, right? And that does something else, right? That will phosphorylate glucose. So you got glucose with two phosphates. That phosphate is a highly ionized form on glucose, so there's a lot of negative charges on that phosphate group. So what can you tell me about glucose if it becomes even more polar when it has those additional negative charges on it? Will that make it more likely to leave the cell or less likely when glucose becomes more polar when it is phosphorylated? Okay. When it becomes phosphorylated, it becomes more polar, which means it can't get through the cell membrane. So these ATPs not only allow glycolysis to take place, but it traps glucose inside the cell. For sure, glucose will never be able to leave that cell. And most cells are very stingy. Right? Once glucose becomes phosphorylated, a typical cell will never release that glucose back into the blood. There's only one organ in your body that can do that. Right? And that is, and we mentioned this already, and that is the liver. The liver has the ability to break glycogen down to glucose, and that glucose, right, can leave the liver and go into the blood and deliver blood to all other tissues. So the only altruistic organ in your body that will donate glucose to everybody else is the liver. So that probably is interesting and important to know about. Okay. All right, so all other cells phosphorylate glucose. That traps glucose inside the cell. That's the end fate for glucose in most cells. All right, so here we have a nice diagram of free energy. You're familiar with this, right? As we go up this scale, then these molecules have more free energy. So if we go from glucose down over here to some intermediate that we're going to call number one, all right, what is this? Is this an exergonic or endergonic reaction? Glucose has lower energy compared to intermediate number one, right? So that is an endergonic reaction. So we have to put energy into this biochemical pathway, and where does that energy come from? Look, we have two ATPs. Two ATPs being converted to ADP. So ATP going to ADP is exergonic, releasing energy. That energy acts as an activation energy for what metabolic process? Glycolysis, right? So glycolysis uses up two ATPs. All right, and then once you have glucose with two ATPs, then the remainder of glycolysis can take place. And going from intermediate number one to pyruvic acid, is that exergonic or endergonic? That's exergonic, right? We're going the other way. Energy is going to be released. There's more than just three steps for this one. All right, but where is that energy going to go? In the form of some chemical bonds or high energy electrons. So glycolysis will take two NAD pluses and convert them into two NADHs. Right? And tell me again, what's NADH, oxidized or reduced? Reduced. And what about those electrons in there? High energy, right? And that shows it on this diagram, right? It's diagrammed very nicely. NADH is lower free energy than NADH. Right? And here's another part of the biochemical pathway where we have two ADP and inorganic phosphate. They're put together to make ATP. And what can you tell me about this reaction? ADP going to ATP, exergonic or endergonic? It's endergonic. And where does that energy come from? Glycolysis, right? This series of steps of exergonic reactions. And that doesn't happen just in one step, but how many steps by the time we get to pyruvic acid? It happens once here and once here, so that happens twice. So over in terms of ATP production, how much ATP is produced by glycolysis? One, two, three, four. Right? But to get glycolysis started, how many ATP did we need? One, two. So what is the net production of ATP? It is 4 minus 2 or 2 ATP by glycolysis. All right, and was that, did we say that on that first slide? Two ATPs? Ah, look at that. Two ATPs, good. We don't have to modify that slide. How about NADHs? Two NADHs, and that's what we have right here, two NADHs. So this is just a nice representation of some endergonic and exergonic parts of glycolysis. All right, metabolic pathway, which means that there are a number of intermediates. So here is glycolysis written out a little bit more specifically because it tells you the names of some intermediates. It doesn't tell you the enzymes that are involved in this. And let's see, I forgot. What about the syllabus? Did I say we're going to learn all of these intermediates this semester, or did I not mention that? Wow, you know, I think, okay, so this semester we won't know the names of all of these intermediates or enzymes, right? But you should at least know what the products are, right? Pyruvic acid, ATP, NADH, and the quantity of these things. And you should also know how many carbon atoms are in pyruvate? Three. And you break glucose down, you get two pyruvates because there's six in glucose. All right, well, when I look at this illustration, there is something that we can appreciate, right? And that is, what can you tell me? Okay, I see a bunch of solid arrows, but I also see some dotted arrows, dotted line arrows. So what does that mean? For sure, glycolysis can happen what we call in the forward direction, glucose going to pyruvic acid, but guess what? Glycolysis, on this illustration, can glycolysis go in the reverse direction? Yeah, because it's a double-ended arrow, or there's two arrows going in opposite directions. Okay? And in order to make that ATP, glycolysis has to be operating in the forward direction, the solid lines right here. Well, what is one of the substrates that are necessary, right, for glycolysis to work? Okay, well, you need ADP. Without ADP, glycolysis won't work, right? And there's something else that's really important. There's something else, another substrate that's listed on this diagram that you'd need in order to have glycolysis moving in the forward direction. Okay, I see it. This illustration might look a little bit complicated, so I'll point it out to you. It is NAD+. Right, so don't forget that little plus right there. Without NAD+, glycolysis can't go in the forward direction. Right? If there's only NADH, which way is that going to force glycolysis? Back the other way. Right? So NAD+ is necessary for glycolysis to operate. All right, so that's all I think I want to mention on this particular slide. If I need to go back, I will. Okay. Well, all right, well, here I am back at that slide. All right, so pyruvic acid, remember, has two possible fates. What are the two possible fates for pyruvic acid? Or what conditions do these operate under? The conditions are aerobic respiration or aerobic conditions or anaerobic conditions, right? Those are the two possible conditions. And under anaerobic conditions, what happens to pyruvate? It gets converted into, I heard it, lactic acid, right? Anaerobic, right? Under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid gets converted into lactic acid, but under aerobic conditions, what happens to pyruvic acid? Enters the mitochondria, all right? Entering mitochondria, I don't want to talk about right now. I want to talk about a little simpler process that is what we call anaerobic respiration, all right? So we got pyruvic acid made by glycolysis, and it just so happens the cell is running low on oxygen. What happens? The lactic acid pathway, right? And this is what was on that first slide. What is the lactic acid pathway? Well, here is the chemical formula for pyruvic acid. And how many carbons does it have? Three, just like what I told you, right? And it converts into lactic acid. And how many carbon atoms are in lactic acid? There are three. So there is no CO2 being produced by this reaction, right? There's three carbons and three carbons, right? But what is necessary? What kind of reaction is taking place right here? I see NADH going to NAD+. There's an oxidation reduction reaction taking place, right? So the lactate dehydrogenase is an oxidation reduction reaction, and these electrons are going to move from one molecule to another. Electrons will move from NADH into lactic acid. So lactic acid is what? The reduced form or the oxidized form? It's the reduced form. Pyruvic acid is the oxidized form. Another way of saying this is that pyruvic acid becomes reduced. Under anaerobic conditions, we call that anaerobic respiration or maybe even fermentation. So when muscles fatigue, we get a buildup of lactic acid under anaerobic conditions. Now, why is this such a wonderful thing? Okay, I see it on this reaction right here. It might not be really obvious to you, but here's a hint. Don't forget, put a little plus right here by NAD, NAD+. Okay, so what is really one of the beautiful things about this reaction? It produces not only lactic acid, but also it also restores NAD+. And what is NAD+ necessary for? NAD+ is necessary to keep glycolysis moving in the forward direction. Right? So that is important. The other important thing is, right, this reaction gets rid of pyruvic acid, gets rid of pyruvate. Let's go back to glycolysis. If pyruvic acid builds up, what does Le Chatelier's principle say? If pyruvic acid builds up. So if pyruvic acid concentration goes up really high, what is the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle say about glycolysis? It's going to go backwards, right? So that lactate dehydrogenase reaction, right, makes sure that glycolysis moves in the forward direction by replenishing NAD+ and getting rid of pyruvic acid so that glycolysis moves in the forward direction, not the reverse direction. All right, so that's really the two of three really important reasons for this biochemical pathway. All right, and under what kind of conditions does this take place? Pyruvate to lactic acid. Anaerobic conditions. And where does this take place? In a mitochondria or cytosol? Cytosol, that's right. Okay, because we also know that in order for pyruvate to enter the mitochondria, there has to be oxygen present. It has to happen under aerobic conditions. And guess what? We're ready to start talking about under aerobic conditions now. Unless you have a question. Who's got a question? Anybody got a question? You might just want to draw out pyruvic acid, reduced or oxidized. Lactic acid, reduced or oxidized. NADH, reduced or oxidized. That's always a really good hint because everybody probably right now would know that NADH is the reduced form and NAD+ is the oxidized form. So if this reaction is producing something that's oxidized, what else has to be produced? Something that's reduced, and that's lactic acid. All right. So can you picture where this is on this initial diagram right here? What have we done so far? We talked about glycolysis and this side reaction under anaerobic conditions. Okay, so now we want to look at this last row of biochemical pathways. What happens under, what is this last row? What's the condition inside the cell? Aerobic conditions, right? Aerobic conditions inside the cell. All right, look at all this. Okay, lactic acid pathway produces only two ATPs, right? Because that's what glycolysis produces under anaerobic conditions. Red blood cells, you've probably looked at red blood cells, they don't have mitochondria. As a matter of fact, they don't even have a nucleus. There's no room for organelles inside a red blood cell because they're loaded with a chemical that carries oxygen in our body, and that's hemoglobin. Inside a red blood cell, there's only room for hemoglobin, so it doesn't have mitochondria. Red blood cells can make some ATP, but not via aerobic respiration, only through glycolysis. Right? Lactic acid pathway occurs in muscle, both skeletal and heart muscle, when oxygen falls below some critical level, like when those muscles start to contract very rapidly. Right? And during heavy exercise for skeletal muscle, there is blood supply is cut off, right? Or if there's pathology in a blood vessel to where blood can't get in there because of a blood clot or some other kind of blockage of a blood vessel, then this lactic acid pathway can take place, right? Glucose can still be used to make ATP, but under these conditions, how many ATPs can be produced for every glucose? Heavy exercise, vascular blockage, how many ATPs for every glucose? Only 2. Okay? 2 is better than nothing, right? But 2 doesn't strike me as a really big number. There's a lot more energy in glucose. Let's see how our cells can get at that additional energy. We'll talk about that really soon. I want to talk about some other kinds of nomenclature. Whenever you see this term glyco, I see it in glycogenesis, I see it in glycogenolysis, I see it in glycolysis. It has to do with glucose metabolism, right? Glyco has to do with glucose. Glycolysis is doing what to glucose? Glycolysis, breaking it down. What does genesis mean? Making, okay? Glycogenesis, and this particular case, it's making glycogen. Glycogenesis is the process of making glycogen. And what about glycogenolysis? Glycogenolysis is the opposite of glycogenesis. It's the breakdown of glycogen. And what's the building block of glycogen? Glucose, right? So glycogenesis requires glucose to make glycogen. Glycogenolysis will break glycogen down into smaller glucose molecules. All right. So glycogen is made up of thousands of glucose molecules. But your cells can't store these thousands or millions of molecules of glucose because that's going to draw water inside the cell because of tonicity. Right? Did we talk about hypotonic and hypertonic already? Right? If there are millions of glucose, free glucose molecules inside the cell, the water concentration decreases and water is going to be drawn inside the cell. That would be, for instance, like being put in a hypotonic solution and the cell is going to burst. So what a cell does is take all these millions of glucoses, puts it on one molecule, and then water won't be drawn inside the cell. The cell will be able to maintain its shape. All right, so skeletal muscle and liver, primarily liver, store a lot of glycogen. Glycogenolysis is the process where glucose is released from glycogen, just one at a time. All right, so glycogenolysis clips a glucose out of glycogen, and as a result of that, it produces a glucose with one phosphate on it. So what does this phosphate do? It makes this glucose six, it's on the six carbon, that's where this six came from, but there's only one phosphate. Since it has that phosphate, it makes it a very polar compound. So glucose six phosphate can't leave a cell. It can't leave a cell. It's trapped inside the cell. But you know what we said? We said that the liver actually is altruistic. It can release glucose into the blood. So the liver has an enzyme that can take this phosphate off, right? And it will just produce a regular old glucose that can leave the cell. And so probably you should be able to tell me the name of that enzyme that takes this phosphate off of glucose. Is it a phosphatase or a kinase? Phosphatase, right? And it's named after the substrate that's called glucose-6-phosphatase. Liver has glucose-6-phosphatase, and then glucose then is free to leave the liver to go into the blood. Other cells don't have glucose-6-phosphatase, only the liver. So here are some important terms. Now some of these terms are going to look very similar, but they're spelled differently. If you can't see the difference in spelling of these terms right here, then you definitely need to get your eyes checked and get some reading glasses, because it's really important. It's okay if you have to stop and think about each one of these terms before you answer a question, because I still do sometimes, right? But eventually, you got to know the difference between these things. All right, glycolysis. You're familiar with glycolysis. What does lysis mean again? Breakdown of glucose, right? Breakdown of glucose into two pyruvic acids. That's probably what this thing over here should say. Glycogenesis is the production of glycogen from what molecule? Glucose, right? Glucoses are going to be put together for glycogenesis, and those glucoses can be retrieved from glycogen via a process we call glycogenolysis. So do you see glycolysis and glycogenolysis are kind of similar terms? One is breaking glucose down, the other is breaking glycogen down. Okay, the last term right here, gluconeogenesis, right? So you know what genesis means. It means building, and this glucose stands for glucose. It's the building of glucose, but a special kind of glucose, neo. Anybody have a sense what neo means? In English, it means a word with three letters in it, exactly like neo. It means new, right? It's the building of new glucose, gluconeogenesis. It's the production of glucose from non-carbohydrate molecules, like even lactic acid, maybe some amino acids. And you know what? You're already kind of familiar with gluconeogenesis, believe it or not. All right, so let's go back. I'm going to flip a couple slides. Ah, right here. Didn't have to go back very far. Here, the solid colored arrows, right, represent what biochemical pathway? Glucose to pyruvic acid. What do we call that? Glycolysis. That's the big word. Okay, pyruvic acid, right, going back to glucose, what do we call that? That is going to be gluconeogenesis, right? So this reaction can go backwards and forward depending on what kind of metabolites are around. So maybe on this slide, go ahead and jot that down. The solid colored arrows, glycolysis, these dotted line arrows represent gluconeogenesis, the making of new glucose, right? So some people are diabetics, for instance. There's way too much glucose in their blood. And even when they have a very controlled diet, right, they still have too much glucose in their blood because our bodies can do what? It can make glucose, right? So sometimes diabetics have a problem with making too much glucose or gluconeogenesis inside their body. All right, so what about these four terms? You might not be able to describe to me right now exactly what's going on here, but can you at least tell that there are four different terms, and eventually you're going to have to understand the four different kinds of things that are happening, right? Does anybody not see that these are four different words? That's a good place to start. Okay. A couple other words right here, lipogenesis and lipolysis. Now you should be able to dissect these words. Lipo stands for lipid. Lipogenesis is what? The production of lipids. And you know a whole bunch of different kinds of lipids, fatty acids, triglycerides, for instance. Okay? And lipolysis is the breakdown. Okay? And an enzyme that would do that would be lipase. Okay? And that would be a hydrolysis reaction. And you're familiar with triglyceride synthesis already, right? That's that dehydration synthesis reaction. This last term, we're probably not going to get into very much, ketogenesis. Right, that's the building of what we call ketone bodies. Ketone bodies are things that are produced in your body when you can't metabolize glucose or there's no glucose in your diet. It produces ketone bodies. So somebody that's diabetic might be producing ketone bodies because glucose can't get inside the cell. Some ketone bodies, an example of a ketone body will be acetone. Does anybody have an idea what acetone is? What is acetone? Fingernail polish, right? Or fingernail polish remover. And if you take some fingernail polish remover and pour a little drop on the table, what's going to happen to it? It's going to evaporate very quickly. Right? That's one thing about acetone. Evaporates very quickly, and it has a characteristic smell. I wouldn't really call it an odor, but it has a smell like when you use fingernail polish remover. And sometimes when somebody is an uncontrolled diabetic, you can actually smell that acetone on their breath. Okay, so that's a ketone body that happens under pathologic conditions. All right, so what I want you to know, these first four terms, the next two, and maybe we can get into ketogenesis a little bit later. Okay. Here we're going to talk about glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. Wow, what time do we go to?
45.
45, nice. We can get to look at a couple more slides. Okay, so here I see a cell. And this cell could either be a muscle cell or it could be a liver cell. And let's see if we can distinguish maybe between the two. Here we have glucose that's in the blood, right? It's going to enter this cell. What's the first thing that's going to happen inside this cell? It's going to be phosphorylated. Okay, so one ATP is going to be used up to phosphorylate glucose, and so if glucose is phosphorylated, it produces what? Glucose 6-phosphate. That one phosphate ends up on that sixth carbon, and you should be able to tell me the name of this enzyme. Probably got to study some, okay? It is glucose phosphatase or kinase. It's going to be remember, phosphatase takes a phosphate off, a kinase puts one on, so here is glucokinase. So glucose kinase is right here, we'll phosphorylate glucose, and it becomes glucose 6-phosphate, and where can glucose 6-phosphate go? Can it leave the cell, or is it trapped? It's trapped because it's polar. All right, glucose 6-phosphate can enter the glycolysis pathway, and this is one of the first steps. Fructose 6-phosphate is one of the first steps of glycolysis. All right, and if it enters glycolysis, what is this glucose producing? Some two NADHs, two ATPs. Okay, so if this cell needs energy, then this glucose 6-phosphate goes down. But if the energy balance in the cell is high, then what happens to this glucose 6-phosphate? It gets stored as glycogen. Right? So here we have glucose 6-phosphate. It has a little bit of a rearrangement reaction. The phosphate, right, gets turned to the first position right here. The energy level of both of these are basically the same. Right? And then when glucose 1-phosphate gets converted to glycogen, a phosphate group comes off. Right? And so that's going to be a phosphatase that does that. But number one, you should tell me the name of this pathway. I'm not so concerned you know the name of that enzyme, but the name of this pathway, glucose 1-phosphate to glycogen, is going to be called glycogenesis, right? So number one is glycogenesis. Now we have that glucose stored as glycogen. Well, if the energy balance then decreases, this glycogen can be used to make glucose, which then can run glycolysis. What's the name of this pathway right here? Number two, right? It's going to take an inorganic phosphate from an ATP, right, to make glucose 1-phosphate. But what would we call this biochemical pathway? You can't call it number two. In real life, you want to call this? Is it a genesis or a lysis reaction? It's a lysis, right? And here's glycogen, so we want to call this glycogenolysis. Number two, glycogenolysis, right? Replenishing glucose inside the cell. If this is a muscle cell, right, that glucose 6-phosphate can only be metabolized via glycolysis. But if this is the liver cell, this glucose 6-phosphate can be dephosphorylated. That glucose can leave the cell, go into the blood, and the liver then can donate that glucose to other organs in your body. So the liver is altruistic that way. Tell me the name of this enzyme that the liver has that can convert glucose 6-phosphate into glucose. That is glucose 6-phosphatase. Yeah, because a phosphatase takes a phosphate off, a kinase puts a phosphate on. So here you see a really nice balance between keeping glucose inside the cell versus exporting glucose. It's the balance between glucose 6-phosphatase and glucose kinase. They're antagonistic enzymes. And because of that, this liver cell can have precise control and balance of blood glucose levels and even glucose inside its own cell, right? Because they're antagonistic enzymes. All right, so the liver can secrete glucose. So be familiar with these two terms, number one and number two on there, and that's probably an exam figure. All right, yes, questions? Number two. Yep. A kinase will phosphorylate either an enzyme, another enzyme, or some other kind of intermediate biochemical molecule. Ah, glycogenolysis is the name of the pathway, and then the phosphatase is the name of the enzyme that makes that pathway take place. Yeah. Yeah, that's really good when you see that distinction. Okay, any other questions on this one? All right, here I got two cells, two different kinds of organs. Got skeletal muscle and liver. Which one of these two can give up glucose to the rest of the body? Only the liver, right? Because it has glucose-6-phosphatase, which is this number 7 right here. Okay, here is that skeletal muscle. Once glucose gets in, it has no glucose-6-phosphatase. That glucose can never leave the cell. What are the possible fates of that glucose? Well, when the muscle cell is not contracting, that cell is going to store this glucose. What's the storage form of glucose inside cells? Glycogen, right? So glucose can be converted into glycogen. So number 9, you should know the name of this pathway, and you do. What's the name of this pathway? Glucose to glycogen. Glycogenesis, right? All right. When you start exercising, this glucose is going to be used to regenerate ATP via glucose to pyruvate. What is that biochemical pathway? That's taking glucose, snipping it in half. That is glycolysis. So number 2 is glycolysis right here. And glucose is inside the cell is going to decrease. So what does this cell do if it wants glucose? It's going to go to glycogen and break glycogen down into glucose. Right? When that muscle cell starts to contract, so we say exercise. So what's the name of this pathway number 1? You already know it, but you got to think about it because it's a weird word. It's glycogenolysis, the breaking down of glycogen. Glycogenolysis is the downward arrow. You already told me that the next arrow here is glycolysis. Right? And then look at this arrow here. One more arrow, number 3. Pyruvate going to lactic acid. What are we going to call this? You could probably name it by the enzyme. This happens under what? Anaerobic conditions. Sometimes we call this the LDH reaction or lactate dehydrogenase reaction. Either way you want to think about it, that's fine with me. More importantly, this conversion of pyruvic to lactic acid, what is that doing? It's allowing glycolysis to take place, right? Because it replenishes NAD+, it gets rid of pyruvic acid, so Le Chatelier's principle doesn't influence glycolysis, so glycolysis keeps running. And what does glycolysis produce that this exercising muscle cell needs? Okay, here's glucose right here. Glucose is being broken down to pyruvate, so it's not producing glucose. But what does glycolysis produce for this cell when it's exercising? It produces 2 NADHs and 2 ATPs, right? That's probably the most important thing for you to see. Okay, so this LDH reaction keeps glycolysis working, and glycolysis can make 2 ATPs for this exercising skeletal muscle. Okay, glucose can't leave the cell. But guess what? Lactic acid can. So this lactic acid that's being produced by this exercising muscle cell gets secreted into the blood. It goes everywhere in the body, and in particular to the liver. The liver takes it up, right, and can convert it back to pyruvic acid. That's just the reverse of the LDH reaction. There's really no difference in energy between pyruvic acid and lactic acid. It can go backwards and forwards according to Le Chatelier's principle or law of mass action. So when lactic acid builds up inside the liver, it gets converted to pyruvic acid, and then pyruvic acid can be converted back to glucose. How many pyruvic acids are needed by the liver to make a glucose? Yeah, just 2, right? Because they both have 3 carbons. It needs some energy to do that. It needs ATP in order to do that. But what's the name of this process? Pyruvic acid back to glucose. It's the reverse of glycolysis. So it's got to be, if it's the reverse of glycolysis, it's got to be a genesis of some kind. Gluconeogenesis. So number 6 is gluconeogenesis. All right, so the liver cell, right, is not like muscle. It doesn't contract. It always has oxygen. Right, and since it always has oxygen and ATP, it can use that ATP for gluconeogenesis. It can make new glucose. And then, right, if the rest of the body needs glucose, what can the liver do with this glucose 6-phosphate? It can rip that phosphate group off with a glucose 6-phosphatase. It becomes glucose, it enters the blood, and then it can go to this exercising skeletal muscle, right? And what does this exercising skeletal muscle do with that glucose that it got from the liver? Sends it through glycolysis, producing what? It produces, I'll put just number 2 right. What would we call number 2? Glycolysis. What does glycolysis produce for our exercising muscles? It produces, and this can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions, and this muscle is exercising strenuously, so it's under anaerobic conditions. But glycolysis produces ATP. How many ATPs? 2. Okay, a measly 2, not so great. But at least that those 2 ATPs might be able to keep the cell alive or contracting to some degree. So when you're exercising strenuously, not only are you using the biochemistry in a skeletal muscle cell, what else are you using? What other organ are you exercising? Your liver, because it's taking that lactic acid, converting it back to glucose so that this muscle can keep exercising. And this cycle, do you see this as a cycle right here? Glucose, this energy is just floating around. Okay, we call that the Cori cycle. Cori cycle. So that's a pretty nifty little thing, right? Whenever you start exercising these muscles, a lot of good things happen inside a muscle, but it's also really good for the liver. Okay, that's the Cori cycle. Okay, and I think we should answer some questions right now. Question, yes? How long can this cycle go? Okay, here you have this liver. Okay, in order to take pyruvic acid and make glucose out of it, it needs ATP. There is an organelle inside our cells that can make a lot of ATP. We haven't talked about it yet, but it needs a lot of oxygen, right? And that is the mitochondria. So mitochondria produce ATP, which then can support gluconeogenesis. Those mitochondria need oxygen, so after heavy exercise, do you stop hyperventilating right away? Okay? So let's run up these stairs like 1,000 times, and you stop. Does your respiration, does your breathing go back to normal right away? You know what? It doesn't. You're going to be hyperventilating for a period of time. That oxygen is going to the liver to convert all that lactic acid back to glucose. We call that oxygen debt. And so that period of time that you will be hyperventilating is variable depending on the severity of the exercise and the training condition of the person. Okay, that oxygen debt. So that oxygen is going to the liver to rebuild that glucose that was going to go to a muscle. That's called oxygen debt. I'm not so sure your book talks about oxygen debt. I hope it does, but maybe it doesn't. Yeah, question? Absolutely. Let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, so here it says glycolysis, right? But glycolysis is what? Only the solid arrows. The dotted line arrows are going back the other way, so maybe on this part of the slide, maybe you should put down gluconeogenesis, right? Glycolysis and gluconeogenesis are opposite pathways, but they can work off of almost the same exact enzymes. One is producing ATP, the other is consuming ATP. Which pathway is consuming ATP? That is gluconeogenesis. What pathway is producing ATP? Glycolysis, right? Because they're working in opposite directions. Okay, so you got to be just really familiar with all these terms right here and the importance of this lactate dehydrogenase reaction, right? It replenishes NAD+, so that glycolysis can take place, gets rid of pyruvic acid, so Le Chatelier's principle doesn't force this reaction to go in the gluconeogenesis pathway. It keeps glycolysis working. And when glycolysis is working, what is that really magic molecule that we all want inside our cells? Yeah, it's producing that ATP right there. Right? That is the importance of the forward direction of this reaction, which is what we call glycolysis. Okay, got to talk about some more stuff next time, but maybe go ahead, read through this chapter, and sign-in sheet is going around, and I'll see you Thursday.